Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Two New Hampshire communities have been the focus of statewide and even national attention after incidents of alleged harassment and attacks on biracial children. And these are just the stories that make headlines. There are others that don't. Holocaust jokes directed at a Jewish kid, for example, or ethnic slurs muttered in the hallways. So how should schools respond? Do tough policies or community kindness slogans really help? Can schools really teach or impose empathy? What's their responsibility to try? And how hard are they trying? That's what we're asking today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests with us today. Peter Keene is here, social studies teacher for 20 years at the Kearsarge Regional Middle School. And Peter, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Also with us, Middleton McGoodwin. He's superintendent of the Claremont School District. And Middleton, thank you for making the trip. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Also with us, Tom White, coordinator of educational outreach at the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State College. And Tom, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you, Laura.
And joining us by phone, Eric Jackson, president of the Greater Manchester NAACP and pastor at Brookside Congregational Church in Manchester. And Reverend Jackson, thank you again for your time. We appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
Well, and all of you, but I want to just start with a piece of an interview that Jason Moon sent to us. He has been reporting on one of these incidents in the Oyster River District where a young biracial boy was bullied on the bus by another boy who was saying some pretty terrible things, hitting him as well. The boy's mother, Grace Caudell, told Jason after this was publicized, and I'm sure you've all seen the reports, that she and her husband heard from many other biracial families from all over the state with similar stories. Let's start off, gentlemen, just by hearing a little bit from this mom, Grace Caudell.
Their children have experienced moments and instances and incidents of racial denigration and racial hate and molestation in school. And these are 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 year olds. They're coming out. And they're speaking up against the racism that is very under the carpet here.
Again, that's Grace Caudell, whose son was pretty badly harassed on the bus. Her son is biracial, and she told Jason Moon in a piece reported on this morning that many, many, many other mixed-race couples had similar stories. And Tom White, I want to start with you. How well do you see school communities around New Hampshire responding to these reports from parents and from kids? And by school community, Tom, I'm talking about everybody, you know, superintendents, teachers, principals, students, everyone.
Well, I think one of the great things we have is public education. This is what will save us, I think, in the long run. I don't think there's a school district, teacher, principal, superintendent in the state that isn't actively working on these concerns of their students and of these families. These things are playing out in public forums like schools, because often this is where an audience is. For people seeking identity issues, right, of this is what I stand for. And most schools are saying, no, this is not what we can stand for, and I think are raising the issue appropriately in all these schools.
So you see schools paying attention, looking at policies, and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. And, I mean, we're looking at really public education is about how do we really work all these differences in our republic together in a common forum, which is what the strength of our public education system is. So not only do I see students and our teachers and school districts all responding effectively, I'm seeing generally a younger generation of students who are empowered in ways that I have not seen for a very long time. They're the ones often raising the issues as well, saying that this is unacceptable for us in our community.
Well, speaking of superintendents, the superintendent of the Oyster River School District, Jim Morse, Jason Moon also talked to him for his piece. He says a review of the school district's curriculum and anti-discrimination policies is underway. Let's hear a little bit from Superintendent Jim Morse.
We want to be the model. We want to be the system that believes in inclusion and believes in diversity and believes in acceptance. This really gave us a shot in the arm to get going.
Again, that's Oyster River School District Superintendent Jim Morse. Reverend Jackson, how about you? How well do you see schools taking note, taking stock, and maybe making change?
So I see, like with what was just said a few seconds ago, I see schools, I see a lot of students who are activated, a lot of students who right now are saying no, that racism is wrong and that there should be something done about it. But I guess my concern comes with the school system itself, because in order for racism to be present, there has to be some sort of, at least within, if we're talking within the context of the school system, then there has to be something happening in our society for racism to be perpetuated. So I'm wondering, what is it that's being taught in the curriculum? You know, what's happening in our curriculum, in the curriculum that students are learning? Are they being taught about inclusion and diversity? And are they being taught about these things? And two, what kind of zero tolerance policies or what kind of policies do school districts have in place to effectively deal with racism at their schools or campuses?
Well, and exactly. And those are two themes that we're going to look at today, both in terms of understanding. So that gets to the curriculum. And Peter Keene is here, a social studies teacher, but also policies, like you said, Reverend Jackson. And we'll definitely talk to our superintendent, Middleton McGoodwin, about that. But how in Manchester, since that's where you're working, Reverend Jackson, how well do you see schools in general responding to parents and kids when they come up and they say, look, you know, this keeps happening to me?
I would say the response that I've seen is that the school district seems to be fairly responsible, rather responsive. But I look at what happens in regards to the issues with the having a proportionate representation or having African American representation issues in advanced placement courses. So those things raise concern to me. But when I hear the incidents that take place in Manchester, I think the school system for the most part is fairly responsive.
Well, and let's turn to you, Middleton McGoodwin, and I just want to say up front that there's more information coming out on what happened in your community in Claremont, that parents of one of the other children involved have spoken to the Valley News saying the incident is not at all like it's been portrayed. Also, we should note here that the police and the AG are still investigating. So part of the story was quickly fueled by social media and the national media. While investigators are still collecting facts, that takes time. So I'm going to set aside all the specifics in this case for now because we don't know entirely what happened. But the broad question for you, please, Middleton McGoodwin, as a superintendent, how does your district respond when someone says, look, you know, my Jewish child was, taunted with ethnic slurs, or my biracial child was attacked because he is biracial?
Of all the things that a school district is responsible for, the two top priorities, in my view, are to provide an emotionally and physically safe environment for all children, for all staff, for the entire community. Allegations or statements about harassment, hazing, racism, hate are absolutely very serious, and we move very quickly. But this is really an opportunity now, I think, for all public school educators, not so much in New Hampshire, but across our nation, to take a step back and to reflect on what has happened. What has happened is not the only event regarding racism or inappropriate conduct. It's an event that has become worldwide because of the attention given it. But in truth, there are several smaller instances, smaller meaning they don't get the attention, that are alive and well. My objective, predominantly working with the community and with the parents, is to emphasize that let's do this in a controlled, transparent, communicative way and develop a thoughtful and meaningful plan that will be sustainable over time. An assembly program or a class discussion is certainly important, but that isn't going to produce meaningful change. And part of that meaningful change needs to involve the students and the faculty and the entire community together.
Controlled and thoughtful is not how a lot of information is disseminated these days. I'm sure you're very well aware of that. Things just blow up on Twitter or whatever. So I just wonder how you, Middleton, sort of take that breath and say, let's talk about this, let's process it, when outside your school walls, you know, information and charges and everything's just coming at you, you know, 100 miles an hour.
2 weeks ago, I sent a telephone message to the entire school community, staff and parents. And I indicated that the foundation of our district is in the belief that everyone has a responsibility to treat others with respect and has the right to be treated with respect. But those are just words. And though many follow those words, a good number do not. So I emphasized in closure, I said, we need to develop a plan. And I asked for everyone's help and support to do this. It's not a school district initiative. It needs to be a school system initiative involving parents, the community, and students, and our faculty. And that plan is slowly evolving. If we rush to do something to appease the concern, it may be politically wise, but it won't be long-term and ultimately meaningful to reflect change.
Well, and Reverend Jackson mentioned something that I want to ask you, Peter Keene. You know, what do students really understand in terms of the curriculum? Everybody's talked about how students are aware. Tom said they're empowered. But in terms of the curriculum, what do New Hampshire students understand about, you know, slavery, the Civil War, you know, the KKK, the boat that arrived during World War II of, you know, Jewish victims who were afraid they were going to be sent off to concentration camps and they were turned away? I mean, what do our students understand about those less than pretty chapters in our history?
Right. Yeah, I really think that's all over the map. And I think a lot of that depends on the classroom teacher in the elementary school. And I think a lot of that also depends on the curriculum. I can really speak to what we do at my middle school. But I think it's all over the place. And there's no sort of organized, uniform approach because of the nature of social studies in the state.
Interesting. So the state school board says, here are the general guidelines for you, Peter, in your social studies class.
Yes.
But the rest is kind of up to you?
Yeah, there are suggestions in the New Hampshire social studies frameworks where it might give me the opportunity to explore a range of topics that fit into the curriculum guidelines. I might choose to focus on any one of those and exclude some other topics.
How do you decide?
Well, I have gone about it in the goal of trying to inform kids about our nation's past, looking at issues where Americans were in a situation to make choices and the consequences of those choices. Our middle school program for a number of years has used the Holocaust as an event to explore how we treat others and the choices that we make and the consequences of those choices. And we've worked with Tom for a number of years to help us shape what we do.
Do you teach about the Civil War and slavery in middle school? Does that come in high school?
That's
when
more
does
of
that
an
come?
Elementary school topic.
In elementary school.
Typically
okay.
Fifth grade. So lots of kids, they come out of elementary school. They have the little bit of background on the Civil War, end of slavery. And then I think for a lot of kids, they think that's it. And they don't really get to address topics related to, say, Reconstruction, the rise of Jim Crow, until high school in some cases. I do in my curriculum look at the Reconstruction period after the Civil War and the failures of the goals to bring former slaves into equality in the nation.
Well, so sure. So little kids think Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, the North won the Civil War, hurrah, we're done.
Yes, Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King.
Okay. Well, the number for you to join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, New Hampshire schools doing some soul searching about race after alleged incidents in which children were reportedly harassed verbally and physically. We're talking about how school communities across the state respond. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Reverend Jackson, after the Oyster River story was publicized, the head of the Seacoast NAACP said, quoted in Seacoast Online, "No 7-year-old is prejudiced unless there are other external factors to create this type of action." What do you think about that, Reverend Jackson?
I fully agree with that statement. I think, you know, I don't think we're born to hate, we're taught to hate. There are other external factors that impact that. What you're taught in your homes and what you learn at school. And, you know, if you're not taught these things, particularly at an early age, because how a child is able to learn when they're in elementary school versus how they receive information and learn when they're in high school are two totally different stages of development.
So what external factors do you see? Are you talking about parents? Are you talking about schools?
I would say it's both. Parents, I think what's taught in the home and what's also taught in schools or what is not taught in schools.
What do you think the impact, Reverend Jackson, of, you know, YouTube, social media, just broadly, you know, you can find any and all opinions every time you turn on your phone?
That's true. You can. And probably contrary to, I mean, while YouTube and social media has a drastic impact on learning today, because you can open up your phone and you can be exposed to a variety of information within a matter of seconds. You can read, you know, I can go through about 20 stories in a matter of 20 minutes. But I think, though, there's something about that those who are closest to you, like such as your family, those individuals have a drastic impact, though, on how your values are shaped. So when you receive, I believe, when you receive such information as such online about, hey, go out and support the neo-Nazi rally, there's something that's within your value system that says, hey, wait, this is wrong, and I was taught this at an early age.
So you process it. You may be receiving all this, but you process it through a filter that has been shaped by your parents and your community, Reverend Jackson. That seems
correct.
What you're saying.
That's what I believe.
Here's an email from Mark from Canaan, who says, "This stuff is not being taught in school. Are perpetrators, child's parents being investigated that caused these issues? This stuff is generally instilled at home through the parents." Mark, thank you for the email. And Tom, I'm going to throw that one to you. What do you think? These external factors cause little teeny kids to say the things that this boy in Oyster River allegedly said.
You know, it's really difficult to figure out and pinpoint where exactly things are. And I hate to limit sort of blame here. I think what we're looking at, we're in a culture of transition right now where at the highest levels of society, these issues of sort of narrowing down our identities into symbolic expressions to one another reduces any kind of interaction that we can have. So we're looking at, we talk about what we want to portray culturally. I keep thinking of the Robert E. Lee statue back in Charlottesville. It's interesting to me that, there are two General Lees for me, for example. One is really the bloodiest general in U.S. history, or the General Lee who, after the war, was the first man at his church to kneel next to a black man and say, "You're welcome here," when this black man was ostracized. So which statue do we choose to represent Lee by? And we ended up choosing a statue about a military guy who had nothing to do with the city, but that choice says a lot about the culture created about how you want to interact symbolically.
Well, lots and lots more to talk about. And we've got a lot of people who want to jump into our conversation. So stay on the line. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Keep NHPR in the loop. If you're a sustainer and you've received a new credit card, take a moment to update your payment information. Better yet, switch your sustainer payments to your checking account so you never have to update expired or replaced cards again. Giving as a sustainer for just $10 or $15 a month is the easiest and most powerful way to support the station that keeps New Hampshire connected. Update your information easily at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how New Hampshire schools respond to racial and ethnic tensions, even among little kids. Many are examining their policies after recent reports of problems. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests. Reverend Eric Jackson is with us, president of the Greater Manchester NAACP and a pastor at Brookside Congregational Church. Peter Keene, he's a social studies teacher at Kearsarge Regional Middle School. Middleton McGoodwin is with us, superintendent of the Claremont School District. And Tom White, he works on educational outreach at the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State. 1-800-892-6477 again is the number. Here's an email that came in from Erin in Hollis. And Middleton, I'd like to throw this to you. Erin says, I'm not sure why parents are expected or willing to let schools handle repeated hate speech and assault. If such a thing happens to my girls, I will go straight to the police. Being on a school bus or in a school does not remove criminals from being subject to the law. Enough of giving batterers and abusers a bubble. Erin also says, thank you, by the way, for having a discussion on this important subject. But talk about the law and how it applies to the people responsible for their behavior. Erin, it's a great question. And I know Middleton and Claremont, the police have been involved in investigating the incident alleged to have happened up there.
They certainly have, and that process remains ongoing. When the law is broken, the public school system does not stand in front of the police. But the police department and the public school system, we're partners. We work closely together. There was a clear line between their responsibility and our responsibility. But to the point of the person who wrote in the email, the school district has a critical responsibility to communicate with parents what we are doing, what our challenges are, and what our approaches are, and asking for their support and involvement. School districts can't be successful by working in a silo. They have to be transparent, and they have to be sure that the parents are aware, and if the parents don't support, that dialogue has to occur, because if we're not pulling in the same direction, both sides are handicapped.
Well, so in terms of a physical attack where someone is hurt, that would go to the police. In terms of, you know, an environment on the bus or an environment in class or in the schoolyard where a child feels taunted, threatened, that's more of a school issue. Can you draw those lines?
Certainly. If there was a child on the bus who was taunted or pushed, that generally is handled by the school district working with the students, working with the parents. If it goes to a point where it becomes a criminal act or an act, for example, of assault and battery, the parents do have the right to bring in the police. And in some cases, the parents wish to proceed with the law enforcement. When they do that, then the school district works with the law enforcement, but in a very different approach. Inappropriate conduct, hate, physical aggression, verbal assault, these are not acceptable and not tolerated. But what has been shown by research is that discipline or consequences oftentimes does not stop that kind of inappropriate conduct. What does stop it is a greater awareness of the students, and that requires us to help them develop the skills. Wanting to behave and being able to behave can be two very different things. And so we talked about genetics and children being born into this world. These skills are not genetic. They are acquired.
That's really interesting. So on the one hand, if it's your kid, you know, you want the perpetrator, you know, suspended at least, or, you know, I don't know what, made to mop the hallways every night or something. But you're saying harsh measures, while understandable, don't always work to teach what you're trying to teach, which is love, basically, or racial tolerance.
You're right. The question is, do we want to be responsive or do we want to be proactive? And if we can assist students to improve their ability and awareness of how we treat each other, about our behavior, about respecting each other, and with the understanding that I'm deserve to be respected as well, that's going to have a much, much longer lifespan than a consequence discipline there. We've taken care of that. You've taken care of the incident. You haven't taken care of the behavior.
Tom, I can see you want to jump in.
No, and I really respect that point of view, because in my particular work dealing with, you know, eventually atrocity crimes on a large scale, the biggest mistake we make is that we think that these crimes and things are an event. They're a process. And as you look at how these processes unfold, what he's saying is exactly right on, that you can't criminalize your way out of this kind of thing. Yes, behavior that is violating of law absolutely is a crime. But before that, there are so many opportunities to intervene, to educate, and show a different way to go. And so that's why education is so important in this process that becomes eventually these kind of crimes.
Well, and here's an email to this point from Scott in Dover, who says, again, thank you for bringing this issue to light. When it comes to racial bullying, violence, bias, etc., why don't we ever hear about these bullies being punished? Maybe they are and we don't know about it. Or maybe as minors, there are limitations. Scott says, however, kids can be suspended for similar acts and threats. Why aren't the bullies and parents being held more accountable? Because policies of tolerance and inclusion are important, but non-punishment is almost the same as condoning the behavior. Middleton, I don't think you're saying non-punishment, but you're saying punishment plus?
The consequences, the discipline, the reaction or accountability of inappropriate conduct is definitely part of what we do. People will not know of that because we don't talk to others about a child and the consequences. So that is a line we don't cross. But what's important is I don't want anyone to think that children are not held accountable or adults are not held accountable for inappropriate conduct. They certainly are. You're not going to see about it or read about it above the fold. But consequences and responding to these issues, though it's important, my issue was or point was that we're not curbing it or stopping it by being reactive versus providing opportunities for skills to be developed, for children to be more sensitive about and acquire the skill of empathy and sympathy. You know, the golden rule, how do you want to be treated? And if we can instill that mindset at an early age over time, children will still be exposed to inappropriate conduct or the kind of messages we really don't want them to hear, but they'll have a foundation to respond to that versus being affected as if a feather in the wind and just changing their mores.
Here's another email. Thank you for those earlier ones, Scott and others. Here's one from Matthew, who says, as a biracial child, I was beaten up and called racial slurs here in a high school in Hillsborough County, New Hampshire, many years ago. And this doesn't surprise me, Matthew says, what happened to the two children. Matthew, thank you for sharing your story. And let's go to our callers. And Peter is joining us from Derry. Hi, Peter. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As rabbi of the synagogue here in Derry, we have run across some interesting... You talk about the overt acts of racism and intolerance, but Tom, I think, can speak well to the initial stages of what can get out of hand, such as we are in the middle of the Jewish high holidays right now, and one of the school districts I'm meeting with the superintendent next week scheduled in one of their schools state tests last Thursday and Friday, which is Rosh Hashanah, our high holiday. They've also scheduled a dance for next Friday night, which is Yom Kippur, one of the most sacred days in the Jewish calendar. And this kind of subliminal, I know it's not intentional, it comes from lack of awareness, but this kind of subliminal intolerance makes it easier for more overt types of intolerance to find footing.
So lack of awareness of other where other people are coming from, even what their holidays may be. You know, I'm glad you called, Peter, because Eric Jackson, I wanted to ask you, in a majority white state like New Hampshire, How is it different? How is it maybe more difficult to get that understanding when you're not faced with people from different ethnic backgrounds or different races every day?
Well, I think, once again, as you pointed out earlier, Laura, I think how we're taught about diversity then is through the images that we see through national media Now, not talking about newspapers such as the New York Times or print media such as this. I'm not talking about those, but what I'm talking about is you learn about it through. You might learn about, more than likely learn about race through such venues as what you'll see on television with the hip-hop industry, for example. And not saying hip-hop is bad, but the images that you see on television that really are shaped by people who have a lot of money and a lot of influence, and it's usually just it's not a realistic portrait of black life.
So it's harder to get a realistic portrait when you're not, you know, sitting next to somebody in school or, you know,
right,
playing with them on the same team. Go ahead. Go ahead, Reverend Jackson.
One thing, too, in that also, but I think it's, just because we live in a state that's 95 to 97% white does not mean that that should be an excuse not to have these conversations and be intentional about being a community and truly understanding people of color from a personal perspective as opposed to what's seen on TV and through the media.
Let's take another call. Thank you again for that one, Peter. And Jamie's calling from Samberton. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So I am a father of two biracial children. They're too young for school right now.
Jamie, you're there, or did we lose you? Oh, darn it, Jamie. I hope you call back. He said he was the dad of two biracial children who are too young to be in school right now. So, Jamie, I hope you give us a call back. Here's an email from Joel, who says kids may not be taught to be racist. However, passive acceptance of implicit bias is embedded in every aspect of our society. And I think that's what Reverend Jackson was talking about. One of you mentioned earlier, sort of, I think it was you, Middleton, this sort of discipline, yes, but teach also. The father of the boy who was bullied on the seacoast, Benjamin Caudill, talked to our reporter Jason Moon, and he describes his conversation with the child who allegedly taunted and shoved his son on the bus, shook his son up pretty badly. Let's hear Benjamin Caudill talk about that interaction with the alleged perpetrator of this.
This little child looks me in my eyes and says, I didn't want to sit beside dark-skinned people. So I looked at him and I said, the same blood that goes through your veins goes through Joseph's veins. The same heart that beats in your chest beats in Joseph's chest. He looked downcast and dejected. I think it was more from the shock of Joseph's dad is Caucasian. I really do believe that. And here I am, I'm telling him, you know, you're the same.
Again, that's Benjamin Caudill talking with NHPR's Jason Moon about an incident in the Oyster River District. It kind of brings up, Peter, what we were talking about with Reverend Jackson, and that is, how do you teach understanding when there aren't that many people of a particular ethnicity or race around you? And I just wonder how you address that in your classes.
Well, I'm thinking of an incident that I was made aware of that recently happened in our school when some kids were doing some work with a mapping software. And a girl, a student, said, search KKK. And some other kids were taken aback by that. And in following up with that student, it became clear that she really didn't have knowledge of what KKK was all about. She didn't know what the Ku Klux Klan was. She didn't know it was a racist hate group. And when she was being informed about what that was, she, you know, her face flushed. She was embarrassed. She had this real look of shock that she had said that in class once she was educated on what the topic is. So it goes back to that notion of, do we discipline or do we educate? And I think we really need to explore individual events to find out if we need that discipline or the education.
Well, and in that instance, clearly it was education.
She didn't mean to. She just had no idea. And it's interesting how, you know, for you know, kids in our schools that are, my school, predominantly white, they just don't have that background yet.
Tom?
Yeah, there's so much. And first of all, I want to thank Matthew for his email and for the rabbi calling in and the other things we've heard. And two things that really strike me here is, one, in a state where we are majority white in a particular tradition and things, I've become very conscious of my position, whereby I've never felt in my life ever being targeted or victimized. And what has helped a shift for me is to get beyond this idea that diversity means tolerance, because tolerance is what a privileged position person does, and tolerate someone else who might not be like them. And we're allowed to do that because we're in a different position. I want to shift that conversation away from tolerance into seeing the actual face and experience of another human being. So, for example, in the Oscars a few years ago, Seth MacFarlane was in Hollywood and he made a sort of anti-Semitic joke about how the Jews control Hollywood. And everybody laughed because he's a comedian. They all applauded. And this had just followed a piece of their honoring Christopher Plummer for The Sound of Music. And Nazi regalia was on stage. And he makes that particular comment. Well, the way I wanted to shift that in talking in my family and students about that is, despite the applause and sort of the cultural symbolic response to this, what if there's a Jewish person sitting in that audience who was probably applauding as well out of fear? When you see everyone around them responding that way, you have to accommodate and assimilate into that environment. What we need to see is the person sitting in that audience who is being targeted, not the general acceptance of that. So one of the things we're dealing with here is all the symbolic communication, whether it be the Confederate flag, whether it be what is the KKK? We've entered an era whereby information is so accessible, but knowledge is not, and where we can speak only symbolically. And we're in a time where the social studies and the humanities are being relegated to a lesser status because they're not measurable. They're not science and math, which are also extremely important. But I think we need to really refocus on, given this age of symbolic and limited communication. I mean, after all, this weekend, we've spent all this time on the NFL kneeling over, we've reduced this entire complex discussion into symbolic communication. And that's where education come in and sort of broaden that nuance.
Can education still come in and broaden that nuance? I talked with Middleton about that a couple minutes ago. Tom, you know, he talked about having a controlled, thoughtful discussion. And I kind of said, good luck with that. I mean, you know, things move so quickly. So I just wonder what you think about that. And by the way, information is accessible. Understanding is not. That's a really good way to put the nail on the head there.
And that's if we give our teachers that space, that room, that what I see when I go to, for example, Kearsarge Middle School, I see an entire culture dedicated to this. So it's not a particular classroom teacher dealing with this. It's from the principal down saying that in our school, this is our culture. It's not just a mission statement, but it's embodied in when I'm going there. I'm watching students volunteering for different groups who are now, we're going to respond to whatever this is. And that comes from Peter and his teachers. So it's not just an individual teacher who is a good soul who's going to fight the good fight. It comes systemically, and it comes from school cultures and community cultures that support that kind of discussion.
Okay, here's the big question I'm going to ask all of you after a break. So you'll have a minute to get ready. The idea that, you know, you talked about creating a school culture, and schools have their, you know, we are one big happy family slogans and so forth. Can you, at the school level, teach empathy, kindness, understanding? That's what I'm going to ask you after a break. And listeners, you can jump in on that too. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how New Hampshire schools respond to racial and ethnic tensions, even among young children. Many schools are reexamining their policies after several recent reports of problems concerning biracial children, and other reports of kids being verbally harassed. physically harassed. We're looking at how school communities respond. The number is 1-800-892-6477. The email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. And Gordon's calling from Center Barnstead. Hey, Gordon, go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Please give my regards to Tom. Education is clearly the solution. And I speak highly of the schools in this state because my wife visits many of them. With remarkable results. Just the correspondence that she gets, the hundreds and hundreds of very well-composed letters.
She visits them in what context, Peter? You're going to have to tell us about that.
Oh, she goes and talks to the children.
About?
About her background and how it happened and that this should never happen again, and then builds on that.
And you're going to have to tell us what her background is, Gordon, for the listeners.
Oh, she was a Holocaust survivor hidden as a child by a Christian family.
Wow. And she goes around and talks to...
There's less and less speakers of that type. But she totally connects with these children in a way that I find remarkable.
Okay.
From
well,
the answers and the letters that she gets. And I speak highly. Half the schools you're talking about, she's been to.
Well, Gordon, thank you for the call. And so this is one way. Before the break, I said I was going to ask you how to teach. This is one way to do it, is bring somebody who has a very compelling personal story right to the school. have to interrupt the regular school day, and I'm sure people aren't happy about that. But go ahead, Tom, real quick.
I have to be very careful, too, because I remember she and I, Kathy, is a survivor here. We're in a school, and the school is predominantly of minority population. And I was cautioned before we spoke to them because I might upset them given the current political circumstances people are engaged in. She and I spoke to a riveted audience of students who I'm not sure their concerns had been considered in this particular school district. So I think it has to be very careful. You have to lead in. Just briefly, I remember in Los Angeles, they had shown Schindler's List years ago. They were afraid of anti-Semitism growing in the black community, which is ironic because the civil rights movement was a black and Jewish and veteran event. And so they just brought all these kids in, showed Schindler's List, and these black teenagers began to laugh and make fun of the movie. And so the incorrect conclusion was, see how racist and anti-Semitic they are. But the problem was, had it been set up that way, when you take high school kids who are uncomfortable and show them Schindler's List with no preparation or background, what do uncomfortable middle school kids do or high school kids do? They make fun of it to try to deal with it. And so it has to do with the preparation, the background. You just can't throw people into a situation, which is why Kearsarge is so excellent at what they do.
So, Reverend Jackson, here's the big question that I want to hear from everybody on. And we're kind of touching on it, but let's hit it full on. Can you teach kindness, empathy, understanding? What do you think, Reverend Jackson? Can you really teach that in a school?
Yes, yes, you can. Because when the children are not at home, they spend 6 to 8 hours a day at school in community with others. Excuse me, in community with others, in community with their peers, in community with their educators. So I think those things can be taught.
And how do you go about doing that, Reverend Jackson? I know that's a huge question, but what are some just steps that a school district can take if it feels like it's kind of falling short?
I think to get an understanding of the current values, I think to get an understanding of the values of the children and the community and their parents, I think doing an assessment of that kind, understanding their location and where they are, I think it's seeking to understand how they've been taught about race and how they've been taught about inclusion, how they've been taught about diversity, and I think it's up to the school district to be, and schools in general to be intentional about creating that awareness. What I heard earlier was that there was a possibility of bringing someone from the outside, and there are all sorts of ways that school districts have the capacity and the potential to actually be a space that to actually create the create the necessary awareness and education that a child needs to be able to model and practice inclusion and practice empathy and caring for others.
So, in a way, that's interesting. So, are you saying, Reverend Jackson, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that part of this process is just starting by understanding where the kids are coming from on these issues?
Yeah.
Because you can't address what's going on until you really know what's going on. It's hard to get kids to respond honestly, though, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think you have to create the space to, I think you have to create the conditions for children to actually be able to feel like they are in a space where they can actually also share about where they are.
That's super interesting. What do you think, Middleton?
Without question, student voice is oftentimes not heard. In truth, students are our constituents. And when school districts involve students in an issue and in an anonymous way gather information about what the student is experiencing, they become empowered and they also become part of the solution. You know, it wasn't that long ago that with bullying, we made excuses about bullying. Well, boys will be boys, or sticks and stones will break your bones, and words will never hurt you. And we made those excuses because we didn't know how to deal with it. And we also didn't appreciate how serious and lifelong impact bullying has. We've come a long way, but a part of it also, bullying doesn't stop unless all the staff have had that training, the training of being able to appropriately intervene when they overhear or see a behavior at the initial stages, long before it gets to a point where it becomes much more serious. So I talked about wanting to versus having the skills to. Students' voice needs to be heard in order to develop the plan. But the skills of the students, how do I respond to this? What are my strategies? And also the skills of the faculty and involving the community and parents as well. 12 years ago, I was involved with an initiative called Safe School Initiative. It's before bullying laws came out. And the whole theme was involve the parents, the students, the faculty over time with a common language, a common expectation, and that we self-monitor. And so we did this. It wasn't done to this. And someone from the outside didn't come in and 1 hour make a presentation, though very important at times, that's not the answer. It's a piece of the puzzle, but the real answer is the faculty, the students, the administration, the parents being on the same page, and I said earlier, pulling in the same direction. That takes a little bit of time. It is taking some thoughtful planning, but the thoughtful planning will be sustainable.
So it's teachable, but it's not like a one-year class or one person coming in for a talk. It's a long process.
I believe that my vision is a multi-year process that doesn't end after we finish up the program or we finish up an initiative. It becomes part of the culture.
You know, Tom, different schools have, you know, we are all one family, you know, happy community. My kids' schools have certainly had their slogans, and you know, the kids make fun of them. Mm-hmm. So how useful are these sort of, I mean, you want to establish a community culture, but there are also these sort of slogans that just to the kids sound like, you know, the adults in Charlie Brown, you know, wah, 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 wah. So how do you teach this without the kids going, ugh, there they go again?
That's a trick, and I
you
think
know, add the eye roll.
Right. That notion of establishing a culture in your school where staff are modeling those behaviors that we want to see demonstrated in our students is a key aspect of that. And as is mentioned before, it's not, you know, someone parachuting in and giving the talk. I think schools need to really cultivate that idea of how we treat others. And at Kearsarge, we try to supply kids with some tools for guiding them in those behaviors. And we do a lot of talk based on our examination of Holocaust as a historical event to, you know, start this conversation about teaching kids the difference between being witness, bystander, and the term we use is upstander, that person who makes the choice to act in the, you know, in the moral, responsible way that demonstrates their caring for that other person.
Well, it's interesting. We've been talking about, you know, how we learn, and you talked about modeling the behavior. Reverend Jackson, you mentioned earlier the problem sometimes is it's hard to have these human encounters, these face-to-face moments of understanding, when there aren't that many African-American teachers in the schools. So what do you see there?
So while that's a very complicated dynamic, while it's a complicated dynamic and a challenge, I still don't think it gives one license not to have these conversations, and not to intentionally be able to teach children about diversity and inclusion. So yes, while it's a challenge, I think if we are intentional, we can still teach our children. We can still teach our children to have empathy, to have care for others, and to actually have a deep concern for those who, and to have a deep sense of concern and realize the conditions about why we have racism in our society today. So I do think that it can, while you do have this issue, while you do have the lack of possible human encounters, there are a variety of ways to make that happen. And I think if we are intentional, then students can still be educated about these issues.
Let's take another call. This is Sindiso in Nashua. Hi, Sindiso. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Thank you for having me. So I am the black mom of two biracial children who are still too young for school at this point. But obviously living in New Hampshire, this is a great concern for my husband and I. One of the things that I wanted to point out was I thought it was wonderful what the dad on the speech post said to their child who had perpetrated this, intolerance. But I think that it's really important in a place like New Hampshire where biracial identity could end up being what defines diversity, to actually have the conversation in terms that are more integrated. And so instead of saying, for instance, because I'm a white Caucasian man and my blood runs through this child's through his veins, that means that you as a white child should regard him as equal. Rather, we should be teaching across the syllabus, not just in history, but also in biology, for instance, that genetically speaking, there is more diversity within races than there is across races. And so I think that we need to be thinking about how do we make the curriculum integrated in terms of dealing with racism and intolerance across the board. And if you would just allow me to make one last point, I teach in the School for Global Inclusion and Social Development at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, and I teach a course on cultural competence. And one of the things that I thought was really wonderful that some of your speakers spoke to is the importance of not taking a particularly punitive approach when dealing with these incidences, but actually trying to appeal to alternative dispute resolution mechanisms. And there really has been a ton of excellent work done on this. I'd like to recommend to your readers, to your listeners, two resources that I use and my students find really helpful. One is a book by Donna Hicks titled Dignity, and it is specifically about doing dispute resolution between racial groups and other groups.
Wow.
That have had...
Well, Sindiso, thank you for the information and cultural competency and your background as, a mom of biracial children. And I do wonder, Tom, there are a lot of resources out there for schools to tackle this, even though they may not have everything right at their disposal. Have you heard of some of the approaches that our caller is talking about?
I have, and she said it so wonderfully. If I could add on to her terrific comments, going back to Peter's point, oftentimes we think about teachers imposing a school culture onto students, and I think that's sort of a misnomer. Ideology in any form, whether political or here in a school culture, is only an expression of what already exists. And so the only way it can really work is if it's not imposed from above, because ideology never works that way, but if it's inclusive of those players who are part of it. So when you're talking about a school culture, it's not a slogan. It's that kids are trained every day in how to respond to what's important. And so you're including them because you trust them. We're in a country where we have invested in humanity. We're an enlightened culture with a Bill of Rights that says if we give human beings freedom, they will do the right thing given the proper guidance and culture. when we reduce that to symbols, and one of the biggest symbols we reduce it to is this idea of victimhood. I'd like to shift that away from victimhood to targeting. And that shifts the discussion of the onus is upon us to see our behaviors and not simply seeing people as victims. But we must always recognize them because often we're not the ones who are being targeted, but we're the ones often victimizing. There are so much more, but I know there's so many more folks to jump in
I think we're going to have everybody come back because we're running out of time and we have so many other people who want to jump in. But I will share a comment that came in from Jamie. This is Jamie who was on hold. He says, sorry, his phone died. He says, I'm the father of two biracial children, ages 2 and 3. How to protect our children from internalizing the racist ideas that truly permeate our daily experiences is a cause of great anxiety. And has our family planning on moving out of the States? Wow, Jamie. An important aspect of this, the conversation, he says, that I've not heard yet is the understanding that racism is not all KKK and neo-Nazis. It can be subtle, unintentional, and pernicious. It is my experience and observation that most people hold deep, unexplored racist ideas that impact how they relate to people of color in negative and hurtful ways. Implicit racist bias. More important than dealing with the overt racist is dealing with the hidden racist within us, and especially the deep and entrenched legacy of institutionalized racism in our schools, medical system, businesses, etc., etc., etc. Jamie, thank you so much for sharing, and I'm glad you emailed after your phone dropped out. Thanks, everyone who could not get on the air with us today. We really appreciate it, and we will definitely cover this topic again because it was a great amount of interest. Reverend Jackson, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
That's the Reverend Eric Jackson, pastor of the Greater Manchester NAACP and a pastor at Brookside Congregational Church. Peter Keene, good to meet you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Peter Keene, social studies teacher for 20 years at Kearsarge Regional Middle School. Middleton McGoodwin, thank you so much.
My pleasure. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Middleton McGoodwin is superintendent of the Claremont School District. And Tom White, good to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much. An important program. Thank you.
Tom White, coordinator of educational outreach at the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State College. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.